computer-based technology, predictions of the future. Up next, George Uhr and Cliff on Coast to Coast AM. Two guests for you tonight on Coast to Coast. George Uhr is a business consultant and financial writer who publishes several websites, urbansurvival.com, independencejournal.com, and peoplenomics.com. There are links up there at coasttocoastam.com. George started writing about our next guest as well. We're going to bring in a second, Cliff. Cliff's WebBot project on his website in 2001 before 9/11. And Cliff's data runs, which are generally summarized in 6 or 7 weekly reports, have been used with great success by a few unnamed but significantly wealthy investors, as they describe it. Cliff's website, halfpasthuman.com, reports, tells us roughly where and when the sky is going to fall, while George's daily updates on the urbansurvival.com site give the day-to-day, play-by-play economic and social impacts as things fall into place. Let's first introduce George Uhr back on Coast to Coast. Hey, George, how are you?
I'm doing great, George, and it's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Now, let's bring in Cliff. We're not using his last name because he's got a patent on computer-assisted reading technology, which allows reading from computer screens at up to 2,000 words a minute, reaching into the other areas of hidden potential within language used by humans. He's been developing a system of software, internet agents, and other proprietary processing methods to predict future events. The software project began in 1997, capturing near real-time changes in language patterns within internet discussions. Fascinating. Then employing radical linguistic techniques of his own devising, he develops a model which anticipates future events with some seeming accuracy. And he's our guest. Cliff, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much, sir. Glad to be here.
Now, tell us, Cliff, why we're not using your last name again for people who are brand new to the program.
It really goes to the issue of cult of personality. Too much of our world these days is dominated by people that are out publicity seeking and so on, and I don't really care much about that aspect of it. Rather, I would just like to introduce and present the work as it sits and let people bounce off from there.
We've got some past predictions. George, tell us about your relationship with Cliff beyond what I wrote about. How did this all happen?
Well, I was living on my sailboat with my wife in San Francisco and doing some consulting there. And I got a strange email from a fellow in about June or so of 2001. And he said he has been doing some research and there's going to be this Our Life Will Never Be the Same After It Happens event, and it's going to happen inside of 60 to 90 days. And it would have aspects of military and accident. And I thought, well, now ain't that curious? And so I wrote a number of articles, some of which are still on the net, from the first week or two of January 2001, in which I wrote about a tipping point, which was what was expected in Cliff's model space. And a tipping point is where you're going along through the life of the world, if you will, and all of a sudden you take this huge right or left turn unexpectedly. And it seemed kind of far-fetched. I mean, you know, it was summers on the bay sailing and jazz at Yoshi's, and oh, how can any of this ever change? Well, then one morning in September, we woke up to CNN's live coverage of the aircraft going into the World Trade Center, and I'm going, oh, no, it wasn't the abrogation of the ABM treaty that's going to change everything, which, by the way, it did have the potential to do. But no, it was this huge terrorism media event, and it's been changing our lives dramatically ever since, including something that persists in model space called restrictions on travel.
Okay, Cliff, how did you know that something could happen?
It has to do with, I suppose a discovery would be the best way to describe it, that I made about how humans are using language in their day-to-day world, and now that the internet encompasses a portion of that, in their speech patterns and delivery within their various areas of discussion. We had this long economic sort of focus on it, financial, if you will. Basically, we discovered, like everyone else, that the stock market really is not really ruled by any kind of rational behavior. It's more emotional, more herd behavior. And if one could tie into the emotions ahead of time and so forth, you might be able to make some money at it. But in the process of heading there, I came across the idea that people are using language in an odd way that's almost prescient. And I thought, now, could that possibly be that certain words would show up in very unexpected places in forums, for instance, discussing gardening? One might run across one of our context major word grouping. And that major word grouping might be fear, for instance. It has a lot of emotion attached to it. And usually you might see, I'm afraid of moles eating my bulbs. But if you started seeing fear relative to other things in terms of how the words around that major context were grouped, it and read it as a pattern, it almost seemed as though there was a pattern developing. And then I sort of set out, discovered that indeed it appeared that that is the case.
Now, this series of patterns, are they truly predictors, or are you able to interpret the information?
A lot of it is the interpretation. For instance, we're in a situation where we're bringing back millions of words. And so there is a certain art to this where you have to decide what are important words to pay attention to and what are not. And so you have to know language to a high, maybe even maniacal degree. And then you have to decide that certain words appearing in unusual places are important, and you latch onto them and see what words show up around them. So, for instance, associates don't seem to be able to quite get it sometimes when I see that certain words are going to pop up and are meaningful. As in fall of 2001, when we started picking up the word assemblage, rather unusual word to see showing up in our...
Sure.
And, you know, and it's very archetypical. And so we put it together with a few other words, and it was like, seems to be suggesting that there's going to be an attack on the assemblage. And shortly thereafter, we had the anthrax.
How about that? All right, George, let's bring you in for just a second. I want to do a little review, first of all. You were on July 4th of 2007, both of you. Then you, George, January 1st, 2nd, you had an appearance. Let's talk about some of those events, George, all right?
Sure. Where to begin?
Well, let's pick it up with, let's go back to July 4th, if we can, where you talked about a set of, first of all, economic strain underway. The dollar was going to be hit hard. Boy, has it been hit hard, George.
Yeah, and that's really a testament to the kind of broad brush accuracy that the system get. You know, when you're looking into the future, George, there are two ways you can do it. You can do it as a drill down kind of an approach, and that's the let's build a national database of everything, including how many ear hairs George has, and from that be able to scan millions of human beings. The other approach is to step way back from it and see where the river of events is going. And where the river of events was going last summer was toward the beginning of an economic meltdown. And it's something that had been appearing in model space for us for, gosh, what, Cliff, 2 years or so?
Or slightly longer than that. Remember, we had that initial thing about the Federal Reserve not being pertinent anymore after November. And we just didn't know what year to associate the November with.
Right. And so we knew that there was a building strain going on. And my real focus in school had been something called long wave economics, the 50, 60, 70 year cycles in the economy. And so I was very, very tuned into that. And as we got into the fall of 2007, we went through what Cliff had accurately predicted would be a sort of a step-down series of events as first the subprime crisis unfolded on us, and then we started hearing about SIVs, and we have since been hearing about all kinds of other things, the sovereign wealth funds and so forth. And then we're in a period now, and I talked about this with Ian on January 2nd, where the next thing that comes along will be the problems evolving in the bond market, as well as in late March, we're due to start seeing a massive rise in unemployment, people losing their jobs and layoffs. So it sort of gives us sense of what's about to unfold. And so in terms of the stock market, for example, at the beginning of the year, it was very clear that we were still in that step-down kind of mode. And we actually may have hit that a temporary bottom today. We're expecting to see like a continuing rise in commodities through June, July. But come the first week of October, around the 5th through the 8th, then we're expecting to see something that could be the economic equivalent of the crash of 29 occur.
That bad?
The release language really suggests that there's going to be quite a bit of it. We have a tendency to look at language in two broad categories, building tension or releasing tension. And it has a tendency to clumped together in our model space, and so we can predict that, oh, something's going to occur here because everybody's going to have release language. Now, an example of a release language is the situation of the Rockettes dance team in the movie theater. And they're sitting there, the lights are dark, they're getting ready to watch a movie, and all of a sudden one of them looks down on the end and sees that there's a mouse or a rat about to cross her foot. She screams, the one next to her screams, et cetera, et cetera. By the time it gets all the way down to the end, everybody in the whole theater is screaming, but everybody else might be thinking not mouse, but maybe fire or whatever.
Right.
All the language that would attend such an event, that's release language, because they're releasing the tension and the emotion.
And that's what you're seeing?
That's what we're seeing. We're seeing a huge...
Well, how do we know that the release language, which is what you help use to interpret this, isn't emotion as opposed to knowledge and inside information?
That's a really good question. When we examine some of the things that we've actually been able to predict with seeming accuracy, such as the Northeast power outage, we get to a situation where if we go back and look at the linguistics that we put up, it is almost as though we're reading on the language off of the crawls on the major news things 3 or 4 weeks in advance. Because what we got was the same thing that initially started showing up everywhere, and that is the Northeast power outage happened, and the first thing that everybody thought was terrorism. So if we were actually getting the event, the knowledge, we probably would not have received that component of it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
It's interesting, George, because when you think about a huge impacting event or a series of events, like one of the things we're looking at in model space at the moment is all about gouging of the winds, and it's going to be a huge deal as we go through spring, summer, at least emotionally, and certainly in a much larger part of the country than traditional. If you think about the future and an event, picture a future event as a rock being thrown into a very still pond. And if you look at the rock and the ripples that have come out from it in one direction, that's like history. But there also seems to be a little bit of a print through or a bleed through into prehistory, if you will. In other words, an emotional wave that somehow at a core level influences people's language before the actual event. And there's lots of examples of it. You've talked to Dean Radin.
Of course, the Princeton eggs and everything else.
Yeah. And he did a really great paper about time-reversed human perception when he was at Boundary Institute. And that's still available on the web. You see it occur when people have bad feelings prior to an event, like actress Lindsay Wagner was among the people who had a bad feeling about a particular DC-10 flight out of Chicago years back and decided not to get on the airplane, and that's the airplane where they...
Well, that's the one that went down, isn't it?
Yeah. And so emotional events from the future tend to print into... prehistory or come to us from the future. And what Cliff seems to have been able to figure out is how to dial into language shift that happens down at a preconscious level. You're not even aware that you're picking up the future, but it's acting on you in ways that come out in writing on the garden forum or the architecture forum and so forth.
Well, then Cliff, the things that you're picking up with your computers, Are they subconscious, intuitive events from individuals?
We think of them as leaks.
Leaks.
If you think of humans, the vast majority of humans are indeed that. They are omni-humanity, the vast majority. We're not like, for instance, the reputed gray aliens, which are essentially replicas of each other. No distinguishing features, etc., what are called fourth-order beings. We're fifth-order. That is to say that we have a huge range of potentials of all kinds, everything from skin color, number, the type of your teeth, how they last, you know, how well your toes will do, et cetera, just beyond our understanding. There is no such thing as a standard human, if you will. Therefore, along with that same tendency within omni-humanity, we also find that it has to do with psychic ability. You have people that are just stunningly psychic, and then those that are totally obtuse to anything that's going on at that level, and everything in between. And what we're sort of catching is the everything in between from those people that don't know it, and it's kind of leaking out in how they use words.
Back in July of last year, George and Cliff, you said that there could be a pandemic involving the bird flu, and other illnesses would resurface the first 3 months of this year. We're into the third month. But, George, I do have to tell you that they do say the flu this year in the United States is one of the worst strains they've ever seen.
And it's also, by the way, one which was not included in this year's cocktail of anti-flu medication.
Though I don't believe in anyway, but you're right.
Me either, and put it there, partner. But what's interesting to us is remember that when you're dealing with future emotional reactions printing through into the future's past, which is our present, it's a little strange to wrap your head around. But when you do, what comes through is that some of the events that we'll pick up in the future are the emotions that accompany a meme or a thought virus that runs around the country. I'll give you an example. We talked about at one point there was a meme that was picked up about a 9.3 earthquake happening in Hawaii, and it was the Oahu quake. And we had some of the imagery right about people waking up and walking on broken glass, mm-hmm. power outages and early morning hours kind of stuff. But we also got wrong the magnitude because we referred to a tsunami and something like a 9.0 earthquake. But curiously, that stuff did show up in local media because a few days after...
Okay, George, I'm going to have to stop you there, though. We actually did nail the 6.3.
Oh, yeah, we did that.
I predicted it would be a 6.3.
Now, the 6.3...
The 9 was the separate incident.
Yeah, the 6.3 was in Hawaii, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was later downgraded to 6.1 or whatever. And we got the 6.3. We got the reasonableness of the location. But on that particular one, we've had so many predictions. You have to forgive George here because they do have a tendency to blur. But what he's actually doing is he's confusing too. We had the 6.3 earthquake that we predicted, and that would hit at what we thought would be the 50th latitude range, and in fact, it was the 50th state. That's what we had.
All right, Cliff and George, stay with us. We'll be right back with our special guests, George Uhr and Cliff, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you can track some of the things we're talking about tonight with George and Cliff by going to their own respective websites. George is urbansurvival.com. Cliff is halfpasthuman.com. We'll be back in a moment. We're going to get into predictions pretty soon as well. This is just fascinating stuff, how a computer can decipher so many different forms of communication on the Internet and then put it all together. We'll be back. Cliff, technically, give us an overview of how this works. And does it have a name? Did you give the computer software?
I think of this as a development that I call the language model.
Okay.
And it derives from having worked as a consultant in large-scale SQL database design for a firm whose needs were to store vast quantities of words, we're talking about millions upon millions upon millions, about the things they owned. And then the real issue was not the storage. That was easily handled by the SQL Server. just scaling up and indexing and so forth. But the real trick to it was trying to be able to retrieve it in a human-like fashion. Their first effort would, they'd send off a query and they'd get a result back about 3 weeks later. It was that large. So I started thinking about different ways to store information and started examining language and what was actually at the core of what had to be stored and came up with a different model entirely, and it worked. And from there, started a train of thought that lasted a couple of years, and I ended up with this, what I call the language model. And let me give you a quick example.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's take fear, for instance. It's all over the place these days. It's yes. in candidates' speeches. It's even in your promos. We're all concerned about it, afraid of the police state, or you're afraid of anarchy, or afraid of terrorism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter. What we do is we take fear as a context, and you can associate perhaps 20,000 English words with the word fear. And at one level, we call these aspects. So an aspect of fear might be another word that you might find for it in a thesaurus, such as frightened, scared, afeared, that kind of thing. When we see the word fear itself, as opposed to some other meaningful representation of that word, and there's a great many of them, you'd actually be quite surprised. But when we see the word fear itself, we call that a bespoke term, and we count that a different way and deal with it a different way. And we've associated certain emotional states with the word fear and its various different parameters. So we have these aspects that sort of help us define the context of fear. And beyond that, we have others that are secondary kind of aspects. Now, you'll note that most of the first-level aspects are all verbs. They're active forms of fear. And so they have a different level of intensity, and they have a different level of emotional driving to them. And so they have a different level of duration in time-space. And they're more predictive of certain things. And other secondary words, secondary aspects, such as trembling or shaking or any number of things, including phrases, they have less of an impact. They're less active. They're right. more likely to be adjectives. And so it sorts fairly easily. And we use a language called Prolog, which is a computer language. It means programming and logic, but it's really designed for artificial intelligence. But one thing I need to make clear, the computer doesn't really do the work here. The computer does the labor, but the work, the actual construction of intelligence from data, has to be done by humans.
Okay, and how long does it take for the computer to do its thing?
It can take 19 or 20 days to do the data gathering, and then we start processing pretty much 24/7 on some machines. And they just sit there and grind all this stuff down into a thick, syrupy mass and spit it into an IntelliCAD model space I designed. IntelliCAD is an AutoCAD or a computer-aided design program where you can define an artificial space. So I defined a space that was 60 units high by 60 units deep and by 60 units spread out into the future.
Okay, like in for example, let's say these presidential primaries.
Okay.
Have you done any runs on the candidates?
We generally do not, unless it shows up in a peripheral context. And the reason that we don't is because all the language about them is always hot. There's very little variation. It all has a tendency to concentrate into one level of emotional intensity, so it doesn't really tell us a lot. What we're looking for is changes, not necessarily a static view. Make sense?
It does.
Okay, so what we'll look for is changes in how the word fear might be represented in various different fora, and which is, you know, multiplying forums. And we go into we use the multiple languages. There is a whole variety that we're able to get at without too much trouble these days. And we'll read all of these different things and see what's associated with fear. And it really becomes meaningful for us, for instance, to find that fear is not associated with moles in the gardening forum, but now it's fear of nuclear bombs. Well, hey, that context is very meaningful. If we start seeing that in a great, great number, then we know that there's a general pervading, drifting downward of a high-level fear into a conscious state. But we don't actually read this by counting numbers or counting words. It's a little bit misleading.
Can you determine, George and Cliff, if we're going to go into Iran, for example?
We can get hints that there would be a release language about a military action, and we'll get all kinds of geographic information, but the geographic information may be misleading.
The other thing, and we actually touched on it before the break, is when it comes to picking or sensing the future, you have to remember that a fear event or an outbreak of fear, such as the fear about pandemic flu, it came to the fore in mainstream media in January and February, even though the actual flu itself did not hit the ground inside the U.S. as the, you know, as the bird flu. So we can pick up a fear coming to the fore, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the fear is accompanied by an actual event, if you follow.
What did you mean by in May, June, veterans will take over the National Monument? You said that in January.
What we've got is a situation where there's this general level of, let me say that we slice and dice model space a bunch of different ways and associate these words with various larger context. And so we ended up seeing this thing developing within what we call the Populous USA, of a veterans movement, if you will, that would be centered around a whole long list of grievances, and that it would appear that at some point in this, the maturation of that emotional wave within the social order, that a bunch of veterans are going to get together and decide that, well, they were going to seize, for publicity purposes, a national monument. Now, we get all kinds of geographic references, so it's awful hard to decide which are meaningful and which aren't, so we usually leave those out.
Fascinating.
But the revolution metadata layer, which is language looked at yet another level, is suggesting that revolution in all forms will pervade the social order pretty much planet-wide, based or rising and dropping in intensity depending on where you're at.
How many people does it take to give you the kind of data you need in order to make this somewhat prediction?
You mean how many reads do we have to have?
Okay. Reads.
We might have to run over the total course of a data gathering 90 million or more.
90 million?
Oh, sure, that's nothing. I used to work in the phone company, so we would process 100 million records a month. That's nothing at all. You can do that on a PC these days.
Jeez.
There's an interesting aspect, too, in that there are some areas when Cliff reports on it, we almost deliberately stay away from. Because we don't want to, how do I explain that, Cliff?
We don't want to be part of the problem.
Yeah.
We would rather stay out of it and then aggravate the situation. For instance, let's examine this whole issue of the invasion of Iran.
Okay,
we might indeed pick up something that really points that way, but are we picking that up, or are we picking up a huge push in the media that's going to permeate into people's consciousness that's then drifting backward to us?
You really don't know, do you?
No, we don't. We don't. We can't tell because we're using humans as our antenna, not anything that's actually looking at the event. Rather, what we're doing is looking at the humans as an indicator.
And then there's the issue of something that we see in the future quite distinctly, like the veterans and the National Monument. And the problem there is we don't want to be seen as causative of a future event or precipitators. We're trying to stay out of the freeway because too much official attention on, well, you can sort of connect those dots.
You mean you could be accused of trying to influence the future?
Certainly so. And in fact, this technology, taken to its ultimate level, could easily be used to hijack the future.
Not only that, George, but we've recently come across something called memering, where there appears to be groups, and we don't know if they're state players or non-state actors.
All we can say is that they're organized among
themselves.
They're
organized, right.
And what are they doing?
They're planting and watering and harvesting memes. Memes are like little thought viruses.
All right, give me an example.
Oh, you might go to a particular forum in a day where there's a lot of heavy political news, and you read this heavy political news, and it may have an independent media slant, and all of a sudden the forum gets filled up with questions about whether or not you should let your daughter marry a black man.
Right.
It's always highly charged. It always goes to these visceral issues. It's always intended to distract and divert and re-quantify and re-qualify emotion.
Why?
That I don't answer. I don't answer why questions because that goes to intent.
That's what you're for, George.
And I haven't figured it out yet. You know, there's a lot of speculation on the web about the powers that be.
Is somebody trying to sabotage your work?
No, it doesn't go towards us. It has a greater social impact. We're just simply picking it up.
Right. It's more like a control point, trying to push emotions or preset people so that they'll react in a certain way when a supposedly random event like a mass shooting takes place, that kind of thing.
Do you think the internet can influence people's opinions before anything even happens? Is it that strong now? Who wants that?
Yes. It certainly has the potential on a number of levels, and if one wanted to be really mundane about it, you could talk about merely the neuro-linguistic programming aspect of it. And that is to say, the more times you read about a particular mindset, the more connections within your brain are made, connecting those kinds of words, so you're pre-set up to react to those words.
I think, for example, Republican candidate Ron Paul, who's still hanging in there, barely, but he's got a pretty good platform. I think he was able to utilize the internet better than any of the other candidates. And, you know, if the
I think you're putting a different slant on it. I mean, sorry to interrupt, but from our perspective, it works the other way.
How so?
The reason Ron Paul is successful is because what he is harmonizing with, what he's resonating with in terms of the general memes that are out there.
See, but I was getting was that I think he effectively has been able to use the internet to influence people who use computers, and therefore people who use computers are supporting him in record numbers, and it gives the appearance that he's got this incredible support system, which he may have.
There's two aspects of this, though, that we've got to consider. That is that he was simply the right person that came along at the right time, that that everybody was simply there waiting for that message to be delivered
right.
by a national prominent figure. I buy into that. Another aspect of it is that to a certain extent this works against him, because there's a larger subset of the populace that only gets their media from the mainstream, and because Ron Paul's support is primarily internet-based, he can be isolated, as he has been.
I agree with that.
Not only that.
And that's an example of memering, by the way.
Because my next question was going to be, why can't he kind of pull out from the pack and do better if he's doing so well on the internet? And you just answered that.
Not only that, but in terms of harmonizing, remember, we've got this whole revolution rebellion meme. And one of his early on slogans or visuals was revolution with the E reversed.
Yeah.
And so he harmonized very closely with that. And then as the campaign has gone along, some of the harmony has been lost with that particular persuasion block.
That is an actually a predictable effect, though, because it goes to the core of things, which is that language changes continuously. And in order to keep a social momentum of that magnitude going, you've got to continue to harmonize with the developments of the language as it goes forward.
George,
almost on a day-to-day basis, really.
Can this computer work, Cliff or George, be skewed, or can you be tricked?
We could be. Everybody on the internet would be aware of it, though, because of the massive amount of memering that would be necessary
okay.
to get past our... It would have to be something staggering on the order of... say that that virtually every fora, or every tenth, actually, that would really be all it would take, reported that Mao Zedong had arisen from the dead, and that there was now a new religion formed around this. No offense to religion nor Mao Zedong, just an example being offered. We would pick that up, and we would be tricked by that, yes. But at 10% levels is what it really requires to get through the processing.
Do you pick up any information, for example, that the government might disclose its full knowledge of UFOs? Or can you go that far?
We have big information bulges, we call them, around what we call the context of the contact. And indeed, we have those. We don't have it specific for the U.S. of A government at this point, but we do have... I want to say an escalation of things pointing to some kind of looming apex, a looming peak.
Now, what does that mean?
that over the past few years, since the year 1999, we've been seeing the reported rise of UFO sightings escalate, and the escalation is reaching a point where, it, using ladder math, it'll soon pass the area where 51% of the population is reporting it.
But does that tell us that we are indeed being visited?
I would say so.
Hmm.
I would say actually that what tells us more than anything is how much is how the government reacts.
Can this get information from people if they don't even want you to have it? I mean, is it that strong?
On the assumption, we have many flaws in the system. I mean, let's not make it more than it is. It's very crude. It's very stupid. Software is very stupid.
But does it get better every year?
It gets better all the time because we're always tweaking on it. But basically, if we don't program in for it, we can't pick it out. So it's possible that a lot of stuff slips by and certain things were keyed in on more than others. I would grant that that's probably an operating principle that we hit all the time because we've limited ourselves to a certain number of entities because we just can't report on everything. So in order to slice and dice the whole of complexity of the planet into something reasonable to report out requires necessarily a refocusing. Does that make sense?
Not only that, George, but remember that we have to have the word in our context. One of the reasons we got aspects of military and accident prior to 2001 was we weren't specifically tuned into the word terrorism. So
it
if something,
by the way, it had not reached the public level of recitation that we've got it today. Everybody says the word constantly. It's getting to the point where it's losing its effectiveness. And, of course, by the way, look at how the people who promulgate their power off of it are also losing their effectiveness.
Well, that's true.
And so if we have a future event and it's formed up around a whole new word like fibblezoink, we're not out looking for fibblezoink yet. So we would have to describe that as aspects and attributes of something else.
And we have that something else built in there, and it has a very rude name, which we won't go into. But we had to. We had to have something that were a category where we could just lump the unknown and the officially denied.
Or
boy, is that an active area.
Or you'd miss it.
Correct.
Right. And again, it's kind of like the UFO thing. We don't know if we're going to actually see contact or if it's just going to be meetings on the evening news that are widely publicized. But we know there's something out there.
Now, generally, when do events occur? When do things happen after you think you see them?
It depends on which broad category of type of language we get the information from. We noticed early on, as I was talking earlier, how certain aspects of fear have greater duration or intensity than others. So we have the fear words that are verbs. They're going to have a big impact usually right away. They may have a modifier that tends to stretch that out. So we've sliced the data into what we call immediacy data, shorter term, and longer term. And the immediacy data means it'll happen usually between 3 days and 3 weeks. And we were pretty good with the accidents prior to the Greek Olympics.
Okay, that's a pretty fascinating window. We'll be back in a moment with more on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Don't go away.